Stillwell, Mr. Roberts, is it?
Hi, Mr. Bodo.
Mr. Bodo?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Bodo is how you pronounce it?
Bodo, B-O-D-O-H.
Bodo, okay. And Mr. Katz, I know Mr. Katz is, there he is. He was hiding from me below the bench there.
Silent.
All right, counsel, glad to hear from you on this case. Well, I'm sorry, would you like to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, 3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Bodo, and with Mr. Roberts here today, we represent Emmanuel Artis. I hope this case strikes this court with the same foresight it strikes me. Emmanuel Artis was convicted of trespassing. He was convicted of trespassing on police property. When he went to that property to complain about the conduct of officers, after five officers had excluded him from a public sidewalk with threats of arrest, hands on their guns, and he was arrested by one of the officers who was there.
Let me stop you there, because I think you've hit the main point for me. Was this a public sidewalk or not?
Well, the earlier incident, it was a public sidewalk. In this case, regarding the arrest at the police station, the indication is that this was an arrest either in the parking lot or on the stairway leading up to the police station.
I thought it was on either the patio or the stairs.
Officer James testified that the arrest took place in the parking lot. Officer Sharp testified that the arrest took place in the patio area. And when I specifically asked him, was it on the stairs, on page 84 of the transcript, he said, yes, it was on the stairs. So those were the two areas. It was either on the stairway patio area, or it was in the parking lot.
Well, I've never been to the Petersburg Police Department. We don't have pictures of it.
Yeah, we
actually
do. We do.
Okay.
We have pictures.
But the in terms of X marks the spot for where the trespassing occurred, I guess we have to take that in the evidence of light most favorable to Commonwealth. So in that light, where would you say it is?
Well, with the X marks the spot, it is in that general area. It's right at the top of the stairs or at the beginning of the patio area. If you look at his what he's talking about as he says that, he says it was right in this area next to your A. I'll put an X in this area. He then, when I asked him directly on 84, was he on the steps, he says yes, he was on the steps. So with that all taken together, I can see that if the standard that we are applying is light most favorable to the Commonwealth, it may be the patio, if there is a distinction between the patio and the stairway, which I don't believe there is.
Well, I gather from the record, and I didn't look at the pictures, but to be honest with you, but I read the transcript in some detail, and as I gather, you walk up these steps and there's this, whether it's described as a deck or a patio or something, it's you have to get there to get to the entrance to the police department, is that correct?
Correct. The layout is 10 steps up to the patio area, another step or two steps, and that's the door of the police headquarters. It's the only door the public is allowed to enter into, and so in order to get into the police headquarters, they have to walk up those steps, across the patio, up the next steps, and then into the lobby of the police headquarters. And he was arrested somewhere along that lines, if you believe Officer Sharp. Now, I would point out that insofar as this is a question of law, it is actually a de novo review, insofar as we're challenging not the sufficiency of the evidence on this point, but we're challenging the legal determination about of the judge that was not a thoroughfare or a way or passageway designated for general public access.
Well, just to clarify the issues, I gather there's a couple of issues here. One is the thoroughfare issue that you just alluded to.
Yes.
The other is whether I forget the sergeant's name, whether he had the authority to bar someone from public property. I guess in terms of looking at how we would decide this in the narrowest way possible, we would need to get past, obviously if we resolve the thoroughfare issue in your favor, we don't need to get to anything else.
Correct. There's the ways that you can reach a resolution in this case is either to determine that the stairs and the patio and the parking lot are all thoroughfares under the Johnson terms, or ways or passageways designated for general public access under the Miller v. Commonwealth terms. And that would result in a reversal of the conviction and dismissal of the charges. If one of those...
Well, no, I'm sorry, there's also that third issue, though, of the admissibility of the
Correct.
Bias.
There is that.
Which would at best result in a new trial for you.
Yes, correct. Another issue under that assignment of error, though, is the fact that the judge, because she made this finding that this was not, none of these areas were ways or passageways under the Miller precedent, she decided not to offer a proffered jury instruction on this Miller precedent. And so if the court finds that there's some factual dispute, then the appropriate remedy is reversal for a new trial with that jury instruction. Turning to the other assignment of error, the lack of authority, that is a challenge on the sufficiency of the evidence. And so if the court finds that there was a lack of evidence to support that conclusion, it would be a reversal and a dismissal.
You have two ways to get a reversal and a remand, and you have two ways to get a dismissal.
Correct.
And you'll take any one you can get.
Yeah. Well, we certainly prefer one, but we believe it's appropriate both under the authority argument and under the fact that the ways and passageways of Miller, the thoroughfares of Johnson, the walkways and driveways of Miller v. Harless back to 1929, the stairway, the patio, the parking lot all fall clearly within those terms. I think that's the strongest argument.
Well, counsel, let me hone you in a little bit more on this, because I think that the Commonwealth will stand up and dispute you on that. That point. So I'd like you to address specifically the case law relating to thoroughfare and why you believe the patio would be a thoroughfare.
All right,
or the entranceway there.
The simplest way to put that case law in some detail is you have the Miller precedent, which is the Miller v. Harless, 153 Virginia 228, 1929, where the Virginia Supreme Court approves jury instructions that indicate that public walkways and driveways are not the subject of trespass statute. That involved a college campus, involved walkways, driveways on the college campus. 1972 comes along, and the Virginia Supreme Court looks at that and some related precedents, and they use the term, they say, before our decision today, Miller stood for the proposition that a trespass statute like Code Section 18.1-173 applies to publicly owned property other than thoroughfares. So adopted the thoroughfares argument. Then this court in 1990 in the Miller v. Commonwealth says, based on these decisions, we hold the term thoroughfares as used by the court in Johnson is limited to ways or passages designated for general public access. So the question becomes, is this parking lot, is this stairway, is this patio a way or passageway designated for general public access? Now, if there's a factual dispute here, the jury instruction should have been given. But it's clear, I believe, that this parking lot in front of the police station, when you look at the pictures, you actually see that the only way that you get to the stairs is through the parking lot. This parking lot is a way or passage designated for general public access. It's owned by the city. Anyone can park there when they're going into the police station.
Right, but assuming that we look at the factual points in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and in response to my question about the patio,
yes,
it's seems to me that we don't need to be talking about the parking lot.
Because this is a de novo review and a question of law, looking at the interpretation of the statute, how the statute applies. This is not a question where you use the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. This is not a sufficiency of the evidence question. This is a interpretation of the statute question. So it's not light most favorable to the Commonwealth.
Let me stop you right there. I think I don't want to mix apples and oranges here. You're right and you're wrong, I would suggest to you. You're absolutely right. It's a de novo review of the law. And certainly it's de novo review of whether this is a thoroughfare or not. But that's why I asked the original question I did. We have to begin that de novo analysis from the point of where did this crime of trespassing occur? Where is the X? And we have to take that X, wherever that X is got to be, it seems to me, in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, because they prevailed on that legal point below.
Well, I think that is complicated by the fact that you have James's testimony that clearly puts this in the parking lot, two different spots.
So your position would be that there's at least a scintilla of evidence to support the jury instruction, so therefore the jury instruction should have been given to the jury.
I think there's more than a scintilla. There is a clear conflict of testimony, therefore it should have been given to the jury.
But that's really a separate issue from the issue of thoroughfare. The legal determination of thoroughfare.
Well, the judge determined that none of these, there was no evidence of a thoroughfare involved in this case, and therefore precluded the instruction. So I don't think it's entirely independent.
I mean, it may be that all three of these places, wherever it is a thoroughfare, yeah. And I gather that's sort of what you're arguing.
Yeah, that's one of our positions. So going to the issue of this patio, you have to cross this patio. To say that this patio is not a way of public access to get to the police station is to create a legal fiction without any reason to create that legal fiction. You don't conduct police business. When you file the complaint, you go inside to talk to the dispatcher. The dispatcher does not hold her business out on the patio. You have to cross that patio to go inside to talk to the receptionist behind the desk in the lobby. That patio is part of the way of public access from that parking lot to that lobby of the police headquarters where you can talk to somebody inside. And insofar as there's a suggestion that this is somehow equivalent to a porch on a house, I think that's a mistake, because that would be to, that sets aside the fact that if you're approaching somebody's house, you might be expected to stop on the patio to knock in order to be invited in, but that's not the way it works in a public facility, especially a public police department. This lobby was held out as open to the public for somebody to go in there and file a complaint. That is established by the testimony of Officer Sharp. Therefore, to go into the lobby to file a complaint, you have to cross the patio. You have to cross those stairs. That's all a way and way or passage designated for general public access of this public facility, the police department.
Thank you, counsel. Can you, you've got about a little over 3 minutes.
Yes.
Could you get to the evidentiary issue?
The evidentiary issue as to the, you're talking about the bias or the videotape?
Right.
I believe that we articulated best, I think, in the reply brief, where we point out the fact that we did tell the court that we believe that this had implications for showing the bias of the police officers. As it applies to Sharp, the testimony known to the court at the time and the testimony on the record was that Sharp was the supervisor of these officers. At the time that Sharp said that he or directed Dillard to make the arrest, and the time he was testifying, he knew that Dillard was the officer that one of the officers, Artis, was there to complain about. The conclusion, therefore, is that Sharp may have a reason to testify in a less than perfect way based on the fact that he was the supervisor of an officer that Artis was there to complain about in order to protect himself, protect his officers. That goes to the bias issue. And as to the good faith belief, the sort of distinctions that the court made and that the Commonwealth is advocating for, saying that this is an entirely unrelated issue, is inappropriate legalism at this point. Insofar as the good faith belief is a subjective belief, it reasonably would be expected to include that earlier incident and the jury could have found that this was the same pattern of lawless harassment that he was suffering by the police. Therefore, that's why he was resistant to the officer's direction to leave the property. That would be sufficient to constitute a good faith, even if wrong, belief that he had a right to be on the property.
Counsel, under the law, it's a pretty broad standard in terms of admissibility on the bias piece, isn't it?
It is. And I believe that because the court realized, or because the testimony is clear, that Sharp was the officer in charge that night, and Dillard was the officer, that he knew that Dillard, or that Artis was there to complain about Dillard, or he subsequently found out by the time he testified, That should have come in to show the fact that he had a reason to be biased in his testimony in favor of his officers over artists. That incident should have come in to show the fact that he actually did have some bias, the fact that he actually, his testimony was unreliable, and that can also ultimately lead to the conclusion that Dillard's conduct was more in line with the conduct described by Officer James than by Officer Sharp.
Help me here, we're just following up on Judge Decker's question. What would have been admissible, it seems to me, is the relationship, the supervisory relationship between the witness and the officer he was there to complain about. He certainly wouldn't have been permitted to have the witness or to offer speculation that, in other words, you let the fact finder draw the conclusions from the relationship. You know, you're the mother of the defendant, aren't you? Or you're, you know, and I guess you could follow up and saying so. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be dumb to ask the question this way, but I guess you could. Is your testimony today colored by that relationship? And I suppose the answer would be some form of no. But nonetheless, I think Judge Decker's point is well made that in terms of being able to cross-examine an opposing witness, it's always relevant to go into bias or prejudice, but there are limits on how far you can go with that. And clearly, but it seems to me at least at a minimum, and I'm sure Mr. Cass can comment on this, you ought to be able to establish the relationship. Would that be your position?
I agree that you can establish the relationship, but I think it goes the step further when you're considering the fact that he's testifying. I believe it was about 9 months after the incident.
Well, let me ask you this. I know yes. It's in the record. As I recall, the proffer of what the testimony would have been to the extent it was proffered was fairly convoluted. Can you help me?
The proffer that we testified, and it's consistent with the video, is that the video shows artists on a public sidewalk being excluded from that public sidewalk by about 5 Petersburg police departments, who then follow him down the sidewalk with hands near their guns and threatening to arrest him while he's on that public sidewalk. I believe that
the purpose for offering that was specifically what was presented at the trial court.
The purpose for offering that was to show the fact that these officers who are testifying that about Artis's conduct that night may have a reason to be biased, to cover up what these police officers actually did that night, and that artist was there to complain about.
Okay, fine.
Thank you.
By the way, Judge Decker and I messed up your rebuttal, so I'm going to give you 2 more minutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Katz.
Good morning. May I please report?
Good morning.
I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. And I'd like to begin with the issue of the precise location for the thoroughfare analysis, because in the arguments today, and even on the brief, I think the second assignment of error is not sufficiently focused to provide this court with the correct standard of review to resolve that question. It assigns error to the trial court's determination that it was an appropriate place. But specifically, which error of the trial court is being addressed, which alleged error, would govern the standard of review? If the claim is the trial court erred in denying a motion to strike because this wasn't an appropriate place, then obviously the standard of review is going to view
those
facts.
When you say appropriate place, you mean like
location.
Public thoroughfare?
That standard of review would be viewed in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth. If, however, the assignment of error is to get at there was a proper jury instruction that should have been given, then we ought to be looking at that in a light most favorable.
Judge Alston made that point very validly. That's apples and oranges, and we need to be very careful how we approach this.
And I want to address both for the benefit of this court so that the issue is clear. If the claim is I was entitled to this jury instruction and the trial court erred because it didn't give it to me, I think in the addendum that I've provided in brief, that's at page 162 and 163 of the transcript, the trial court makes clear its determination whether we're talking about the parking lot, which would be in a light most favorable to the defendant, or we're talking about the patio, which would be in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth. I don't think either of those locations is a thoroughfare. That's the finding of the trial court in denying the proffered instruction. And the standard there is obviously abuse of discretion. Did the trial court err in making that determination?
Are you sure? I mean, why wouldn't it be de novo? Why wouldn't that legal determination that it's not a thoroughfare be a de novo review?
Well, what you'd be asked to address, if that's what the assignment of error is getting at, is whether the trial court was wrong. And obviously, if it's an error of law, then it's always an abuse of discretion. So I think that would answer Your Honor's concern. If after de novo review you conclude that the trial court was wrong as a matter of law, the parking lot should have been the thoroughfare.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong in this analysis, and if I am, tell me where you disagree with it, but if you start from the premise that you can't have a trespassing in a public thoroughfare, and the issue is properly raised in the trial court as to whether or not the location of the arrest for trespassing was in a public thoroughfare or not, and the trial court found that it was not, then it seems to me our analysis is de novo as to whether the trial court properly interpreted the definition of public thoroughfare, but deferential to the Commonwealth's, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, as to the historical fact of what precise geographic location this alleged trespassing occurred at.
I agree with Your Honor entirely. I think the only thing I would add to that is, if we're talking about the proper jury instruction, then we are concerned with the parking lot. If we're talking about what was proven at trial, the determination to deny the motion to strike, or if we're talking about the authority or the thoroughfare in that context, then we must look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and then it's the patio. And I'm happy to talk specifically where the patio...
Let me just ask you, in terms of, doesn't it get further complicated if the trial court said none of this is a thoroughfare, you know, for purposes of the law, it's trespass, whether it's the parking lot, the, you know, stairs, or the patio. Doesn't that then further complicate our analysis if we as a court believe that the judge as a matter of law was wrong with regard to the parking lot? Because then we have no factual determination to link to. Does that make sense?
It does. I understand Your Honor's question, and I think my effort is to focus this court on the specific question being asked, and so that is a problem for this court, not a problem, but that is an issue for this court to resolve in its opinion if it's being asked to address the propriety of denying the proper jury instruction. I submit if the only issue before the court is whether the trial court erred in denying the motion to strike on that ground, then this court is guided by the factual findings, both by the trial court, the conversation at that time, as to the patio itself. And if I may, I would submit, in undertaking that abuse of discretion analysis with specific respect to the parking lot, if an alley on housing authority property can be deemed to not be a thoroughfare, I would submit that this trial court did not abuse its discretion in coming to the conclusion that the parking lot itself was not a thoroughfare. It is clear that public property can be the subject of a trespass charge, a trespass conviction.
But as your opponent colleague pointed out, at a minimum, there were two different characterizations as to where things went wrong. And if there are two different characterizations, one which clearly would not qualify as a factual determination to be made by a fact finder, and one that could have been made a factual determination to be considered by a fact finder, why would it not be error to refuse an instruction which would allow the fact finder, i.e. the jury, the province to make that call?
Well, I think I would respond by saying, if the trial court can correctly conclude in either event that neither of those locations are thoroughfares, then it is not error to prevent the jury from getting that choice. Because
to get to that point, you would have to conclude that a thoroughfare is determined as a matter of law, and
yes,
that there is no factual predicate whatsoever other than the historical facts supporting the trial court's determination.
Well, the court, even viewing the facts in light most favorable to the proponent, could resolve that factual dispute, even assuming that it took place in the parking lot. As a matter of law, it is not a thoroughfare. And I submit, you know, one could craft a stronger argument for a location that's not a thoroughfare, but I would answer, this particular court did not abuse its discretion in coming to the conclusion that it did, that the parking lot itself was not a thoroughfare, based upon the previous analysis of the alleyway in the Housing Authority case.
And I appreciate your response, and the way that I was listening to you set it up, and you did a very good job of setting it up, is obviously this court is going to look at the trial court's disposition on a motion to strike different than it's going to look at a trial court's determination as to the propriety of a jury instruction. Motion to strike, is there any evidence to support the Commonwealth's theory of the case? Sure. You go forward. Now we're getting to the point where pendulum sort of shifts to the other side, and now the defendant gets an opportunity to put on his case. He puts on his case to basically cast some doubt as to the Commonwealth's case to the extent that it can. And if there are facts to support that theory of the case, then the jury, as a fact finder, should be able to consider those facts in light of the law that the judge is going to provide to them. And so the inquiry as far as this court shifts. And so your position would be, in a nutshell, that there is no evidence to support the idea that this place where the arrest took place did not qualify as a public place as a matter of law.
That is correct. If this court is undertaking the analysis of the jury instruction and the standard of review appropriate to that question. But
well, that's so much to talk about here, but in terms of following up on Judge Alston's question, given our definition from, I guess it was Miller, that a public thoroughfare is a passage designated for general public access, and given the contention of the defense that they're in such a place, how could it not be a factual resolution, at least some scintilla of evidence to that effect that would justify giving the instruction to the jury and let them make that call?
Well, again, my only response would be governed by analogy to Miller. And I would say that if a passageway, an alleyway on housing authority property can be called out of the exception for thoroughfares, then surely a parking lot is susceptible.
But I think the operative word you used was can't, or words were can be. In other words, it depends. And it depends on the degree of use, I suspect, and the type of use and that sort of thing. And because obviously, as a general proposition, not every public, as you pointed out earlier, not every public way is a thoroughfare.
And I would argue, as there are, as Your Honor is suggesting, there are thoroughfares and there are thoroughfares. And a way that the public is invited to travel upon, and I suppose the archetypal example, that would be a sidewalk in a park.
I mean if it says employees only, you know, on the sidewalk or at the entrance or in the parking lot, I think we can all agree it's public land, but it's not a thoroughfare. But if there's a different character attached to it because of the way it's signage or the way it's designed or the invitation because of, you know, public entrance or something of that nature, we've got a different proposition. But what this all boils down to is, why isn't all this a factual resolution that's the proper province of a jury?
Well, and I appreciate Your Honor's concern, and again, my only response must be that the trial court resolved this as a matter of law, and it was entitled to do so in light of the precedent of Miller. But I would submit, and let me inject this into the argument before I run out of time, even under Finley, and the cases that follow Finley-Herring, I would submit this assignment of error has not been specific enough for the particular error alleged by the trial court.
Which assignment of error?
The second assignment of error.
Okay.
Because the second assignment of error can be interpreted to address the ruling as to the denial of the motion to strike, or it could be interpreted to address the ruling as to the failure to give the proffered instruction. And there's a different standard of review for either of those claims, and the assignment of error is not specific as to which has been alleged.
But I think our jurisprudence suggests, though, that as long as the trial judge had an opportunity to rule on the issue that is presented on appeal, we're going to obviously give the defendant the benefit of the doubt. And it's clear that here, defendant made a motion to strike, which we've already talked about the standard for assessing a motion to strike, and also offered the jury instruction, which the trial judge refused. So why isn't this matter properly before the court?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, and I understand Your Honor's point, I would draw a distinction between the application of 5A12 and 5A18. Yes, the trial court had an opportunity to rule, as it must under 5A18, but pursuant to 5A12, it has not been framed appropriately for this court to review for the very uncertainty that we've discussed today. There are different standards of review and an entirely different analysis depending on what the claim is. Before I do run out of time, and I appreciate Your Honor's questions as to this issue, and again, as I've indicated, it must be an error of law, and I would submit the trial court did. It must be a matter of law, and I would submit the trial court did not err as a matter of law. But if we could turn to the first and second issue and the patio specifically, I would direct the court to page 47 and 48 of the joint appendix, in which Sharp testifies specifically as to the layout, the parking lot, the 10 steps up, the one step, and the entrance. And he makes clear that this event occurs on the one step from the door to the patio. And if I may, that is at beginning at line 22 on 47 and continuing through.
Now this is the step immediately outside the door that leads to the patio. That's what you're talking about?
That is correct.
Why isn't that a public interest then?
For the reasons I've argued on brief, if we're talking about the patio, it is not a thoroughfare. It is the path to the building, and so intimately connected to the building that it is a part of the building. It is functionally
the same. It's the only way the public can get into the building, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it is you've arrived there. You're not going anywhere.
But
when you get to the
patio. Wasn't he trying to leave, though, at that point?
Well, he wasn't leaving. That was the point. He was on the patio and directed to leave, and he remained in place. And so the issue, the larger issue in this case is, what recourse does the police department have at that point? I mean, they are a property owner, and the intention of the defendant in this case is to view it, and it's understandably so. It is very rare that you have law enforcement barring somebody from law enforcement property. Those are unusual facts. And so the temptation is to view this through the normal lens where the police are acting on behalf of some other property owner. They must have been authorized to exercise this barman authority. But that's not this case. This is the police property. And the police, like any other lawful person whose property it is, has the ability to tell people to leave, to exclude
them. I think we can all agree as a general proposition there comes a point when anybody can be banned from any public property.
Yeah.
But the point, I mean, I think the narrow focus that the laser we're trying to zero in on here is this place where this arrest occurred, where this alleged trespassing occurred, is it a place, a way or passage designated for general public access? Because that's the language of Miller. That's our precedent we're bound by. Tell us why it's not.
And I would submit, for every way or passage, you must reach an endpoint. And so it may be a way or passage until you get to your location. And then it's no longer a way or passage. You are there. And the patio, for our purposes, the Commonwealth's position would be, you've arrived. You're no longer on your way anywhere.
Well, certainly if you're inside the building, I think that's maybe a valid argument, because you're inside, you've arrived at your destination.
Well, if we agree on that point, then it's a question of line drawing and how thin do we slice it. And I would submit the patio is close enough to the door, it's close enough to the property that it's functionally the property.
Close enough for government work.
You've got about a minute and a half, and I've got a question I'd like to
I'm going to let you answer Judge Decker's question about how long it takes you to do it. Do it well.
Here's the question. You, on the evidentiary issue, you make a 518 argument, and you don't make a merits argument. Does that mean that if we get to the merits, the Commonwealth has conceded the merits?
I wouldn't concede anything. I would admit that the
well, there's nothing in the brief, so I want to just
moot court 101.
Let's just talk about that.
Like, there are thoroughfares and there are thoroughfares.
Not trying to put you on the spot, counsel, but
I will agree that the post hoc rationalization for why it would be valuable evidence is compelling.
Okay.
Surely, if it had been framed that way for the trial court, that would have been a compelling argument. But in the absence of the presentation of this post hoc rationalization, the trial court didn't have the benefit of any of that argument. All that it was told was, well, this earlier encounter, as a general matter, would be relevant for bias as to this particular officer later in time at the police department. There wasn't any business about, well, he was the supervisor. He had a reason to challenge his credibility as their supervisor. He wouldn't want them to be seen in a bad light for it to be blamed to him. That argument wasn't presented to the trial court. And so I make the 5A18 argument. I don't have a compelling response if the merits are reached without conceding anything. But
and let me ask you one other question about that, one follow-up, if I might, Judge.
Sure.
So if the video was improperly excluded, if we get to the merits and we determine that the video was improperly excluded, does the Commonwealth have a harmless error argument?
If this court were to reach the merits and determine that the fact finder should have been allowed to view the potential for bias, to hear evidence of the potential for bias, it would be hard to argue that was in fact harmless, I think.
Thank you for your candor, counsel. Yeah,
thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Katz. Counsel, give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. I'll be very brief. I want to focus, first of all, on this idea that because there is case law establishing that an alleyway was somehow not a thoroughfare, then certainly that can be extended to the patio. The reason why that alleyway was not a thoroughfare, if you look at that case, was because there was an ordinance passed saying that it was no longer open to the public, and I believe there were even no trespassing signs. Therefore, it was not a way or passage designated for general public access by law and by those no trespassing signs. I also just want to point out, in response to the idea of, well, what recourse does the police have? First of all, there are plenty of recourses. If there was this was obstruction of justice, he could have been arrested for obstruction of justice. If it was breach of the peace, he could have been arrested for breach of the peace. If this was disorderly conduct, he could have been arrested for disorderly conduct. But he couldn't have been arrested for trespassing without the authority and without being in the place subject to the trespass statute. But it's also important to point out that why is it important to arrest a man who wants to complain about police corruption that he experienced earlier in the night? Why is it so crucial for the police to arrest him for that purpose? The First Amendment rights have to be in the back of this court's mind.
Well, counsel, in fairness, he was being arrested because he wouldn't leave the property.
He was
refusing to leave and was causing a disturbance.
Because he wanted to be there to talk to a captain. He wanted to be there to talk to a captain. They were imposing manner restrictions and time restrictions on his complaint. There's no reason
he
couldn't sit
there. Well, this was 4 in the morning. And
exactly, and
he was told the captain wasn't available, and the sergeant who was the commander spoke with him, right? And
yes.
Offered to get him the form and help him out.
And then imposed this time and manner restriction.
We don't have a First Amendment. I mean, let's not go down.
But the point is that if this was disorderly conduct, if this was obstruction of justice, or if this was breach of the peace, we wouldn't be here. But he was arrested for trespassing. So the question about what other recourse does the police have would be misleading to take that road, because the trespass law is clear, and if they want to arrest him for trespassing, they have to have these requirements in place in order to convict him for trespassing. The authority in the proper place. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We're going to come down and greet counsel, and the court will take a short recess.